The FOMC has been devoting considerable attention to issues relating to its exit strategy, and we are confident that we have the necessary tools to implement that strategy when appropriate.
That's exit strategy as in bank bailouts, not the war in Afghanistan, which we'll talk about later in the program when we look at Hillary Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State over the first 6 months. But first, the economy. That was the Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke, who's doing something very unusual for a chairman of the Federal Reserve, usually a very staid position. He's going on somewhat of a publicity tour. He'll be doing later today a big town hall meeting in Kansas City, moderated by Jim Lehrer, no relation, of PBS. So that's an indication of where this particular Fed chairman is at. And we'll talk about what it says regarding policy, what it says about our own money as we go along here over the next few minutes. And as the Dow passes 9,000, while the unemployment rate passes 9%, all kinds of questions about how the new economy resembles the old are being raised. Goldman Sachs posted a record second quarter profit. You've heard this, more than $3 billion in 3 months. And the big bonuses that helped fuel the frenzy of the last few years are back, at least at Goldman, and taxpayers helped. Goldman is also the center of controversy over a new technological profit booster called high-frequency trading, in which super-fast computer trades may be manipulating the market. And the chair of the FDIC wants more bank regulation than other Obama aides, while it's becoming harder to get arbitration with your credit card company. So there's a lot going on this week. Also, a joint diplomatic meeting with Treasury Secretary Geithner and the Secretary of State Clinton and their counterparts from China this week. So let's take stock. Back with us is MIT economist Simon Johnson, former chief economist for the IMF. He blogs about the economy, especially the big banks, at the Baseline Scenario. Hi, Simon. Welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to be back with you, Brian.
There are at least three controversies surrounding Goldman Sachs' big new profits, and I want to start there. Let me get your take briefly on each. One has to do with this thing called high-frequency trading, trades being done in milliseconds that critics say may be computers manipulating stock prices. Are you familiar with high-frequency trading and how it works?
Yes. I'm not a computer expert, but I have looked at this before. And I was part of an SEC independent commission that looked at some related issues back in 2000, 2001. I think a better technical term for it actually is low latency, which means basically that the big people with deep pockets, including Goldman Sachs, have better computers than the rest of us, and they get to see orders that go, for example, through NASDAQ before anybody else. Now, the time difference is very, very small, but for the kinds of computers we're looking at, it's like, for the rest of us seeing information days before anybody else gets it. So it's a big deal.
So can the market be manipulated through the technology?
I don't think manipulation is necessarily quite the right word. They get an advantage, a definite advantage. And actually what was really striking last week was as soon as the news broke on a broader scale through the New York Times, both Senator Charles Schumer and Arthur Levitt, former head of the SEC and an advisor to Goldman Sachs, came out very clearly and said this is inappropriate and it must stop.
So what could be done about it?
Well, you can just stop it. I mean, these are rules about how these markets operate. They're not embodied in the Constitution or anything like that. It's a question for the markets to sort out by themselves. And if they won't do it, then the SEC steps in. SEC clearly has the power to prevent this kind of unfairness in markets.
And what about Goldman's return to big bonuses? Critics are complaining that it was this very system of perverse incentives that helped create the housing and derivative bubbles and then the meltdown that we're currently in. And here we are. Now more than 10 months, or only 10 months, after the crisis began in earnest, Goldman is already back to big profits with this computer trading and other things going on, and already giving out these big bonuses yet again. Is the cycle going to repeat itself?
It could well repeat itself. It is ironic, and it's a kind of a horrible, painful, stomach-turning irony. But the same kinds of practices are back. I would say it's probably not so much about the low-latency, high-frequency trading as it is about their market share. Remember that Bear Stearns and Lehman are out of business. So Goldman's market share is up. And we had Larry Fink, who's a very, very powerful Wall Street person. He runs BlackRock. Also last week, complaining about basically the pricing that's being exacted by the big firms who remain. He's saying essentially they have quasi-monopoly power and they're extracting extra money from their customers. Again, this is something that the SEC and presumably the Department of Justice need to look at, and I think they will look at it pretty quickly.
What about Goldman Sachs with its connections on Wall Street that run all the way up to the Treasury Secretary? Some people are complaining that they are getting too much taxpayer money, even as they make these big profits now. Technically, they paid back all the TARP money, but when AIG started to negotiate with its creditors, apparently the taxpayers bailed out Goldman Sachs at 100% on the dollar that you know, people say they should have been taking a hit on with respect to AIG losses.
Yeah, so that's a fair point, a fair criticism. I would actually emphasize those, a slightly different moment came a little bit later, which is when Goldman Sachs was allowed to convert itself to a bank holding company at the end of September last year. That basically gave it access to unlimited credit from the Federal Reserve. And as far as we know, I mean, these details are not public, but as far as we know, Goldman continues to draw on that line of credit. Now, that means basically we're providing an enormous subsidy. We're providing the cash that funds their trading operations, and either they're making this money, these high profits, through excessive risk-taking, which is possible, or they're just extracting this money, these rents, as economists like to call them, from their customers, either through the high-frequency trading or through the greater market share or through some other improper practices.
Any Goldman employees listening right now? What should we think of your company today? 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Or anyone may call on any of these things. For MIT economist Simon Johnson, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Okay, another topic, big one for this week, and I see you've posted on it today on your blog, the baseline scenario. Today and tomorrow, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner are meeting together with two similarly high-ranking officials from China. Is this historically unusual that the Secretary of State and the Treasury Secretary would be in talks like this together?
Well, it's part of something that's been going on for the last few years. It used to be called the Strategic Economic Dialogue. They actually use that name still, but don't highlight that as much. And sometimes people call this the G2. So it's the U.S. and China trying to get together and work out certain issues. I don't think it's ever made a great deal of progress. Obviously, the big issue in the background is China's exchange rate, which has been held at an unfair level, making them very competitive, helping them take away market share and jobs from other countries.
Stop on that for a second, because I know this is a big source of dispute between the two countries, and probably a lot of people don't understand it. The currency in China does not float on international markets like the dollar floats against the euro and all of that.
Exactly, Brian. If you go back 40, 50 years, of course, the dollar didn't float either, but at the beginning of the 1970s, we stopped trying to fix it, and now the dollar moves freely, subject to all kinds of vagaries and strange behavior, perhaps, but it is not fixed by the U.S. government at all. We don't intervene. China does intervene, and so when they tend to run a big export surplus, they're exporting more than they're importing, their currency, the renminbi, would tend to appreciate, become worth more. They prevent that, and instead of letting the currency rise, they accumulate reserves, and over the past 8 or so years, they've accumulated over $2 trillion in reserves, most of which we presume is held in U.S. dollars. So they've become a very large lender to the United States through this mechanism of manipulating their exchange rate.
The U.S. apparently also wants China to get their people not to save as much money, and that's kind of ironic. The U.S. is in the trouble that we're in, partly because people were addicted to borrowing and spending in their personal lives, as well as, I guess, at the corporate level. And yet we complain that people in China save too much. Why is that?
Well, this is very gentle diplomatic language for trying to get them to expand their economy. So we say, you know, we need you to save less, which means spend more, and that would mean buying more imports from the United States and from other countries. That would reduce their current account surplus, and that would mean there's less exchange rate adjustment needed. But there's very little. I mean, the Chinese are doing a little bit in this direction with the fiscal stimulus, but not enough to make a big dent. They still have a current account surplus close to 10% of GDP forecast for this year. That's the official IMF forecast. That's huge. That's very, very big. It's a big distortion in the global economy. Not saying they're responsible for the crisis, but they're certainly not really helping us get beyond it right now.
So I'm looking at your blog post on the baseline scenario. The headline is Secretary Geithner's China Strategy, A Viewer's Guide. And you write, according to official previews, the economic topics are China's concerns about the value of the dollar and the amount of debt that the U.S. will issue this year. This is absurd. What's absurd?
Well, what's absurd is that we're treating China with this sort of kid glove deference. You know, please listen to us, be nice to us, you are our big debtor, please keep your money in dollars. I mean, it really doesn't matter to us. If China decides that they'd rather move their reserves into something else like euros, the dollar would depreciate, and that would actually be helpful to our economy. It would boost our exports, for example. So, you know, the idea that somehow, unless China is happy, and, you know, we're beginning to treat China as a difficult, as a parent, or as a teacher who is, you know, frowning upon us. That's crazy. China ran this exchange rate policy. They decided to accumulate all these dollars. The main losers, if the dollar falls in value, is the Chinese, because it's lower. The dollar then has lower spending power for the stuff they want to buy. Doesn't really bother us at all at this point. Now, we don't, because we issue dollars as a reserve currency, lots of people around the world hold them, it's not polite to go around talking down our own currency, so we don't. But if China decides to abandon the dollar and that gives us a 20 or 30% depreciation in the dollar, that will be good for our economy, not bad for our economy. So being so very, very nice to China and very deferential is really silly.
So here is Steve in Manhattan, who says he's an electrical engineer and wants to talk about those high-frequency trading programs that Goldman Sachs uses. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
This is going to lead no place good. This is the next horizon of a disaster. This is going to cause tremendous instability. It's going to cause oscillations without damping designed into this system or without lowering the frequency of trades. The basically what this is a multi-dimensional, uncontrolled feedback system where you can get flows that are occurring between any number of stocks that can cause the system to ebb and flow anywhere between zero and infinity. There's effectively no control on this, and it's going to have an unpredictable response, which is going to cause tremendous tsunamis of flow. And unless there's a control built into it, unless you can model how bad this can happen, unless you can actually model what can happen and put the controls in place in advance, this is going to create a fascinating problem, and I'm just going to sit back and laugh.
Simon Johnson, what do you think? Are you as afraid as he is?
I'm definitely afraid. I don't know what kind of controls they have in it or think they have in it, but Steve puts his finger on a very important point here, which is, you know, all our previous deference to experts with regards to risk management in these big firms, all that deference was misplaced. They had no idea the risks that were associated, for example, with subprime mortgages and all these derivatives they built on top of that. Now, if they're telling us that high-frequency trading is safe and won't lead to, for example, a repeat of that, remember the 1987 stock market crash? So-called program trading in those days was very much considered part of that crash. Well, I'm sure the big firms are going to tell us that can't happen again. They put safeguards in. And, you know, Steve's point is a good one, which is show us the model that will convince us this won't cause instability and big movements, big, huge volatility or crashes. And I think the answer will be, if you look at it hard and long enough, their models and their controls are not convincing enough. And it's a risk. It's no question. They're taking the risk. They get the upside. And we, once again, will get the downside.
Should we look at this a little bit like NASCAR, where they have a rule against manufacturing the cars to go faster than a certain speed?
And it seems that they need to keep changing those rules all the time, because people, the racing companies, find new innovations, ways to sort of not break the rules and yet violate the spirit. So you need somebody who follows that stuff very closely and from time to time disqualifies cars, I guess, even after races.
On the track, they call that restrictor car racing. I don't know what the banking equivalent term would be. But Pam and Seabright, I think, has a question about U.S.-China relations. Hi, Pam.
Good morning. I was listening to the comment about, hey, it's not going to really matter so much if our dollars devalue 20-30%.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't that going to kick gas oil prices and therefore gasoline prices up by at least an equal amount? And that would be tragic.
Simon Johnson?
It's a good point that there could well be an effect on the dollar, on oil prices. Oil prices are denominated in dollars, and if the dollar depreciates, that might push oil prices up a little bit. I don't think it would go up by 20 to 30%. That's not been the past experience. There's no reason to expect that. But you're right that there would be an impact on that. And I guess you have to take a view on whether you should live in fear of China and tremble at every time they raise an eyebrow, you know. And of course we should move away from the policies that made that possible. But do you want to tremble in the face of that, or do you want to get on and go through this this kind of adjustment, get away from the Chinese having this hold over us? And if you're terrified of any kind of adverse consequence, including a little movement in gasoline prices, then the Chinese have an incredible hold over us. The situation, if the call is right, that's what we should fear. The situation is much worse than Secretaries Geithner and Clinton think it is.
Pam, thank you. And Simon, I guess you struck a nerve when you talked about China and the dollar with what you said before, because Vic in Chester also wants to come back on that. Hi, Vic.
Hi. I'm curious, if the Chinese were to go over to the euro, wouldn't they want then to cash our check? And how are we going to pay off that debt? I don't see that happening. I see that crashing our economy. And also, if all of a sudden our products will be much more affordable, you know, for export, what products are those?
Simon, go ahead.
Those products? Are we selling a lot of shoes and TVs and radios, cars? We can't even sell our cars in China.
Yeah, we seem to be importing a lot of consumer items. What is it that we're going to export to the growing Chinese middle class if they stop saving? So he's got a couple of questions on the table for you there, Simon.
Sure. Well, the U.S., of course, is one of the big exporters in the world. I mean, I understand we've lost a lot of traditional manufacturing, including low-end items. But in terms of aircraft or in terms of more sophisticated machinery, in terms of business services, we are absolutely one of the big players. We have. It's true, and it's interesting that we've lost our self-confidence in exporting, and that I think is part of what you hear in the caller's question. But a 10 or 20% depreciation in anyone's currency brings exporting back to the fore, and that's exactly what this country needs to get its external payments back on track. Now, in terms of our budget deficit, that is an important issue. We have a very big budget deficit, and there are issues of sustainability around that. I'm as concerned about that as anyone. But those are not particularly about China. It doesn't matter if China wants to hold our debt or not. That will affect our long-term interest rates by a few, tenths of a percentage point, a few basis points, no doubt. But it's not going to break the U.S. financially. What will break us financially is if we fail to control our Medicare spending. If you look at the Congressional Budget Office's projections, the dominant factor over the next 20 to 30 years for our fiscal sustainability, whether we can afford, whether we can pay our bills, whether we'll honor our debts, is Medicare. I mean, it's unfortunate. It's unpleasant. People don't like to hear it. I guess it's sort of embarrassing or shameful or something, but it's the truth. That is the mathematics of the problem. It's not even the economics. That's the arithmetic.
Vic, thank you for your call. We're going to continue in a minute with MIT economist Simon Johnson. And when we do, I'm going to ask about this charm offensive that Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke is apparently undertaking and what that's really all about. And the little question of a lost $500 billion that a member of Congress challenged Bernanke about at a hearing last week. We will play that clip. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with MIT economist Simon Johnson, former chief economist for the IMF. He blogs about the economy, especially the big banks and international lending and so forth at the baseline scenario. And we are taking phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC. Web questions and comments at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. I want to play a clip since we were talking about the dollar and international currencies and money flowing across borders. A clip of an exchange last week between Florida Congressman Alan Grayson and the Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke on foreign lending. And listen to how much money Congressman Grayson is going to say has magically or mysteriously disappeared.
They take the dollars, lend it out to the banks in their jurisdiction, that helps bring down interest rates in the global market for dollars. And meanwhile, we're not lending to those banks. We're lending to the central bank. The central bank is responsible for repaying us.
So who got the money?
To financial institutions in Europe and other countries.
Which ones?
I don't know.
$500 billion, and you don't know who got the money?
The loan went to the loans go to the central banks, and they then put them out to their institutions to try to bring down short-term interest rates in dollar markets around the world.
Simon Johnson, can you translate that exchange into English?
I'll try. So what happens? What happened during the crisis was people were short of dollars around the world, and this was a big part of the disruption of credit markets and why interest rates between banks. If you remember, people talked about this. Some talking about this mysterious LIBOR, the London Interbank Offer Rate, as sort of an indicator of the end of the world because the banks weren't lending to each other in dollars offshore, so not inside the United States. And what the Fed did was it lent dollars to other central banks. To, for example, the European Central Bank or to the Bank of England, and received in return the currencies issued by those very reputable, credible central banks. And that let the Bank of England and the European Central Bank and the Swiss National Bank and others, for example, on-lend the dollars to their financial institutions under their jurisdiction with whom they have interactions. So there were more dollars in this offshore market. So Mr. Bernanke knows that he lent it to these highly reputable central banks, and they will be able to pay him back. What he doesn't know is who they lent it on to.
And what's this about Fed Chairman Bernanke doing an un-Fed-like publicity tour? He's got a town hall meeting today moderated by Jim Lehrer, no relation, of PBS. He's making other appearances. What's with the charm offensive from a usually gray-shrouded office?
Well, I think the quick answer is he's campaigning for re-election. He's up for reappointment as chairman of the Fed in January of next year. He's definitely the front runner for that job, but he wants to, you know, make sure people understand him and like him. And I think more broadly, he's trying to offset this move from Congress to force the Fed to open up to what they call it GAO auditing. He calls it, I think, correctly, congressional scrutiny and Monday morning quarterbacking of all of the interest rate decisions made by the Fed. And so in order to persuade people that the Fed shouldn't be subjected to that much greater level of transparency on the terms of the Congress, and particularly Representative Ron Paul, who's leading that charge, Chairman Bernanke is trying to show the Fed has become more transparent, and it has under his watch, and he's trying to assure people that he can explain to them why he's done what he's done, why it makes sense, and why it's not dangerous for developments down the road.
By the way, there's a story in the news about credit card company arbitration firms pulling out of the business and some new controversial practices being used by debt collection agencies. I guess these are really two separate stories. But what's happening with these arbitration firms? Why are they ceasing to help people sit down with their credit card companies when there are disputed charges and fees and so forth? And what are the implications for the consumer?
Well, I think the arbitration companies are feeling that the rules of the game are shifting in ways that are exposing them to liability that they didn't have before. And depending on the view, I mean, I think we would all agree that some form of reasonable, responsible arbitration is necessary in this space. It should be an easier way for customers to sort out their problems than, say, having to go to court and sue. There are concerns that consumers have been strong-armed into arbitration agreements. So they haven't realized that they were giving away some of their legal rights. And that's one reason the arbitration companies are very nervous around this. And I think much more broadly, and this also is about the debt collection people as well, there's so many shady practices that are developed in and around consumer credit. We absolutely need a new protection agency for consumers with regard to financial products. But of course, that is something that every part of the finance industry is unanimously opposed to, and even the regulators can't agree among themselves. Or actually, most of the regulators oppose a new agency as well because they think it would take away their powers. So it's really quite a mess, the whole area of consumer credit, not at all conducive to a sustained economic recovery.
Aha, which leads us to something else that I wanted to talk about, because one-party rule does not mean the absence of political conflict, as we are learning. There are now factions of Democrats in the heavily Democratic Congress fighting over health care reform. We talked a lot about that on the show last week. And there are factions even within the Obama administration, as you just referred to, regarding how to overhaul the banking industry. Apparently, FDIC Chair Sheila Bair is the tough girl here, and Bernanke and Geithners and others want to go more slowly or let the banks go more quickly, whichever way you want to look at it. What's the dispute really about?
Well, I think it's one of philosophy, actually, of reform. Everyone pretty much agrees that we've built a financial system that's dangerous, and particularly that we have some very big financial firms, let's say with total assets over $500 billion each. When they get into trouble, you know, the government has felt in the past 9 months, 2 years, it needs to step in and help them. We also have lots of firms that are smaller, that are under maybe $100 billion in assets, like CIT Group, where the government has decided, actually Sheila Bair, I think, was a real advocate of this. Let them swim or sink by themselves. And at least for CIT Group, so far that seems to be working out. You know, it's painful for them and no doubt difficult for their customers, but it's not led to world financial turmoil. So I think Sheila Bair is saying, you know, we want to let the smaller companies fend for themselves, and we want to push the bigger companies to become smaller. Now, no one can quite agree about how that pushing of the bigger companies should happen. And I think that Sheila Bair is on the be tough side of that argument, but it is a little hard to tell. And even she is not sufficiently, to my mind, in favor of a new consumer protection agency vis-a-vis financial products.
Really? Now, here's a quote from Sheila Bair from a congressional hearing last week. She said, "The notion of too big to fail creates a vicious circle that needs to be broken. Large firms are able to raise huge amounts of debt and equity and are given access to the credit markets at favorable terms without consideration of the firm's risk profile. Investors and creditors believe their exposure is minimal, since they also believe the government will not allow these firms to fail. The large firms leverage these funds and become even larger, which makes investors and creditors more complacent and more likely to extend credit and funds without fear of losses." So I take it from what you said that you agree with Sheila Bair about that cycle. It comes back to what we were discussing regarding Goldman at the beginning, and the ability to just return to the practice of taking crazy risks because they think the government's going to bail them out if they fail.
Exactly, Brian. It goes back to the point made by your very first caller. He was worried about the instability of the system, and he should be worried. But on the other hand, you know, if investors think that Goldman Sachs is going to be bailed out because when they fail because of this or other kinds of instability they're inducing into the system, they will be bailed out, then it's a much better bet for outside investors. And, of course, it's a fantastic bet, a terrific bet, an all-time historically good bet for anybody who's a Goldman insider at this point.
We're almost out of time with MIT economist Simon Johnson. Peter in Syosset wants to follow up on what you said about the arbitration companies pulling out of the game of getting credit card companies and their unhappy cardholders together. Peter, you're on WNYC.
Yes. Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I heard, and it may have been on your program the other day, Brian, I'm not sure, that part of what this was about was a huge conflict of interest scandal that the, I think it was the AAA, American Arbitration Association, that their ownership was tied to the collection agencies that the credit card companies would then turn to after winning the arbitration. Okay.
Yeah. Do you know if that's true, Simon? And, of course, I understand that the banks tell me if this is wrong, that the credit card companies themselves help to fund the arbitration system so that the companies are actually dependent on one side in the disputes. And then, surprise, surprise, the credit card companies win 95% of the time.
I don't know for sure if this is true, but I have heard these stories. They seem credible to me, and I think they absolutely call for a serious federal investigation. This is an incredibly powerful point in favor of a consumer protection agency just focused on financial products and consumers and how people get ripped off again and again and again.
And the president went out the other day and supported the idea publicly. If he wants this, the banks are so powerful that they could stop his regulators from doing it or the Democratic Congress from passing it?
The bank lobbies are incredibly powerful right now. In fact, they're probably more powerful than they were before the crisis, if you can believe that, because of the way in which they've been able to come back. And they are digging in very hard against this. It's going to be a heck of a fight. I testified on Tuesday before Barney Frank's committee, House Financial Services, on this point, and Chairman Frank said this himself. He said, you know, that the lobbies are out. We don't know when and how we'll get this legislation through.
All right. Simon Johnson, MIT economist, former chief economist for the International Monetary Fund. He blogs about the economy at the baseline scenario. His new post just out is called Secretary Geithner's China Strategy, a Viewer's Guide. Simon Johnson, extremely informative as always. Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up in a minute, a follow-up to Friday's astonishing interview about the organ smuggling business. We will look at the active dialogue within Judaism about one religion's relationship to organ donations. Stay with us.